Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The editorial cartoon is a dependable measure of press freedom in a given country. As advocates point out, a cartoonist cannot work when there is no freedom of speech and opinion. Two cases illustrate the point. In the early months of the Syrian Revolution, editorial cartoonist Ali Farzad was threatened and eventually attacked for drawing cartoons making fun of President Bashar al-Assad. The thugs broke both of his hands. But crackdowns on free expression of editorial cartoonists don't just happen in dictatorships. In India, Asim Trivedi is well known for drawing hard-hitting anti-corruption cartoons. But last year, he was arrested for allegedly insulting India's national flag in Parliament. He was jailed for more than a week. Both Trivedi and Farzad were undeterred, and they jointly received the Courage in Editorial Cartooning Award from the Cartoonists Rights Network International. On today's program, we'll talk with the director of the International Network, along with the president-elect of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. They'll describe a profession experiencing a major transition with both positive and negative consequences. But first, WorldWatch, a brief sketch of international news. There have been major developments this week related to Syria's civil war. Israel launched airstrikes inside Syria that reportedly targeted advanced Iranian weapons, possibly bound for Hezbollah. A Syrian official called the weekend attacks at the military research facility a declaration of war. Elsewhere, a member of the United Nations Commission on Syria said investigators found evidence that Syrian rebels, not government forces, used chemical weapons. Then the conflict took positive turns. President Assad on Wednesday stopped short of threatening retaliation for the airstrikes near the capital, Damascus. And the United States and Russia agreed to convene an international conference to find a political solution on Syria. The UN Arab League envoy for Syria called this, quote, the first hopeful news on Syria for a long time. After the diplomatic announcement, the U.S. State Department said it will provide an additional $100 million in humanitarian aid to ease the Syrian refugee crisis. In neighboring Turkey, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, began its gradual withdrawal of rebel fighters, which are estimated to about 2,000. The PKK declared a ceasefire back in March. Across the Mediterranean, Libya's General National Congress voted to ban Gaddafi-era officials to hold power positions in the government. The decision comes a week after militants seeking the ban isolated the ministries of foreign affairs and justice in the capital, Tripoli. Elsewhere in North Africa, the chief of a major tribe in South Sudan and a UN peacekeeper were killed in an attack attributed to another tribe. The attack took place in the Baia region, a contested area between Sudan and South Sudan, and among both tribes. In political news, Malaysia's long governing coalition has won national elections. But the National Front coalition that has ruled for 56 years had to fend off the strongest opposition it has ever faced and actually lost the popular vote. The prime minister was somber while acknowledging the victory in parliamentary elections. We'll end on a positive note. In Saudi Arabia, the monarchy has relaxed its laws banning the participation of girls in sports. Female students at private schools will now be allowed to compete in sporting events, as long as they are decently attired. That's it for World Watch. With a few sharp strokes, cartoonists with clever wits can make a point worth far more than 1,000 words. For centuries, hypocrisy and injustices by the political elites have been exposed by these drawings, and have often been the only way to work around text censorship. Now, joining us for today's program are Mark Fiore. He's president-elect of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. We also have Robert Bro Russell, the Executive Director of Cartoonists Rights International. Before we talk about specific cases, let's take a broader approach. So welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Okay. Bro, we'll start with you, and then Mark, you can answer the same question.
Okay.
Why does a cartoon cause such strong reactions? After all, it's usually supposed to be sarcastic or satirical.
What happens is that as we make fun of political figures and social and cultural figures, we, the observers and the cartoon readers, feel better. But nobody likes to be laughed at. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to be made fun of. It's a universal experience. Now, when you're in the political sphere, if you're an elected official or you even take over a country with a gun, it's part of the territory. Criticism is part of the territory, and you have to understand that if you want to be the head of state, if you want to run the country, then this is part of the territory. You're going to be criticized. And cartoonists are so good at it because we use humor, we mm-hmm. use laughter, we make fun of people, and particularly despots and tyrants and people who are in power only because of perhaps the power of the gun. This seems extremely rude and intolerable, and while you are someone ruling with a gun, then you have a gun to do something about it.
Right. Mark, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would actually take one step back from that and get to a slightly simpler point before that even, and that's just the power of a visual message is a lot stronger than something that's purely written. I mean, not to bash editorial writers, but when was the last time an editorial caused a huge uproar, compared to when a cartoon caused a huge uproar? I mean, just in the last few weeks, Jack Oman did an amazing cartoon that took after Rick Perry down in Texas, and the lieutenant governor called for him to be fired, and there was a humongous outcry. And it wasn't because it was an editorial or something that was mainly written going after the governor and criticizing his whole deregulation bent. It was because it was this great visual. Mm-hmm. And that's what cartoons do all the time. And I think that's the main reason why they grab people around the neck and make them notice.
Okay. And one more broad question. What are some of the pressures and threats that editorial cartoonists are now facing? Mark, can you start off?
Sure. I think I'll leave the physical threats to Bro to handle, because he's dealing with people that are in repressive countries and places where, you know, just being a cartoonist puts you at risk. But for example, in the United States, the threats, you know, while they fortunately they're physical threats to the cartoonist a lot less of the time, even though that does happen as well. It's more, economic threats that you have to be careful of here, whether it's self-censorship, trying to pull your punches, or editors trying to keep everything kind of a little calmer and being afraid to offend people.
Okay. Yeah, and Bro?
I deal with cartoonists who are at risk and who have been threatened. Cartoonist Rights Network International is really... we're really not a cartooning organization. We're a human rights organization, and we defend the free speech and human rights privileges of political and social cartoonists around the world. Right now, as we speak, we are trying to find out more about a cartoonist who has been disappeared inside of a very violent Middle Eastern country right now.
Right.
I don't even want to mention his name, and I don't even want to mention the country, because we're not sure whether this would make the situation better for him or worse for him.
That's
what
terrible.
What we're really trying to do right now is find out whether he's still alive or not. There's another cartoonist in another country in South Asia who is being attacked, and he's being harassed and attacked by, you can't say the police, but mm-hmm. you might say the secret police. They're beating him up on the street, running him over with motorbikes, threatening his family. He has right. had his passport stolen, and he doesn't know exactly stolen by whom. So it's even difficult for him to get out of the country. There was another cartoonist from Bangladesh who we helped get out of the country after he was convicted and given a 7-year jail term for a cartoon that was deemed disrespectful to Islam.
All right, and there's another case of the Israel imprisoning the Palestinian cartoonist recently.
Yes.
So it's not just in countries that are having revolutions.
Mohammed Sabane, a really wonderful, creative, and very sensitive cartoonist. We have a picture of him in one of our stories on our website, and he's sitting in front of the White House. He was the guest of the U.S. State Department on their annual visitors program a couple of years ago. They bring in a group of Middle Eastern cartoonists to take a tour of the U.S. every year. He had a wonderful time. He met so many American and Canadian cartoonists. His cartoons are always so gentle and powerful. But he's always very, very careful not to be racist and not to foment violence. But he was arrested by the Israeli Defense Forces, held incommunicado for about 3-4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there was so much pressure to get him out of jail that they took him to court. There were some trumped-up charges against him, and I'm not sure if he's out yet. I think they said that he could serve his time as the time served, but he may have another month on top of that. But we know it's because he was a journalist and a cartoonist that he was identified in the first place.
Right.
At least we're pretty sure.
And I want to get back to some of the specific cases with and actually and give examples of the cartoons they were drawing. But I want to have another broader question again. Mark, what are some of the other issues that cartoonists are now dealing with as the journalism profession overall is going through such a painful transition?
Well, I think a number of them over the last, several years, just like other parts of journalism, a number of them are trying to preserve their jobs, whether that is on staff at a newspaper. Some of the smarter newspapers are actually hiring back cartoonists that have been laid off previously, and other newspapers are actually not eliminating the cartoonist, but are keeping it because they know it's such a valuable position for a publication in a given city or state. So, but barring that, I'll say barring the smart publishers and barring the smart newspapers, some are getting shown the door, and those cartoonists are having to figure themselves out and figure out their next step. And I've said before that it's not a death knell. It's potentially an opportunity to figure out how you're going to get your cartoons out there, how you're going to communicate directly to people, or how you're going to show your work in a different way. It's a glass half empty, half full kind of thing, and I tend to fall on the glass half full side.
And how does the internet, social media, and ease of posting videos with animation, is that a positive aspect?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'll be blunt. It's saved my behind for the last 12 years or so. It's something where comparing it to the old way of being a traditional print cartoonist on staff with a newspaper, the internet, whether you do animation or still do print cartoons, static cartoons, the internet's the Wild West compared to the old days of being on staff and having a real, job with a capital J. You've got to figure things out along the way and be a lot more entrepreneurial. And, now with social media over the last few years, you have the ability to connect with people in a lot more meaningful way than you can in a newspaper.
Right.
People see your work and they can respond to you immediately, and you can respond to them immediately. It's a conversation which at times can get pretty daunting, but I think overall can bring a stronger angle to cartoons.
Right. And Bro, could you provide an international aspect of this?
Yeah, it's cartoonists have followed right along on this citizen journalism phenomenon on the internet, on social media. And with the new programs that are emerging almost every day, somebody who's never picked up a pen in your life can do your own animations and your own cartoons by using kind of inventories of cartoon characters or animation scenarios that you can plug your own dialogue and your own kinds of characters in. There's a wonderful example of this in the United States. A police department, and I believe in California, has been satirized very strongly. Mark, do you remember what the name of that town is? Mm-hmm. That I want to say Reston.
In Northern Virginia?
No, I think this. No. This is
in California. I'm trying to think. Is it Southern California?
I believe so. A series of animated videos making fun of the police department.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I haven't seen those. I would love to see them. Are they using Extra Normal or something like that?
Yeah,
the animation
sure
program.
I was talking about, and I can't think of the website to go to. Renton, R-E-N-T-O-N. If you Google Renton Police Department or Renton Police Videos, they are hysterical, and they're powerful. And one of the reasons they're so powerful, too, is because the cartoonist is clearly an insider in the police department, but he's operating absolutely, absolutely anonymously. We don't know who the person is. Now, this can cause problems if a cartoonist is not responsible and kind of dealing with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But it really opened up a tremendous wave of a whole new level of social criticism against the police in a way that the police's normal networks of control and, what do I want to say without getting into trouble, covert
censorship. You can get in trouble, it's okay.
Rear burner, back burner, censorship just don't apply. And it really turned the police department inside out, and I thought it was a wonderful example of citizen cartoon journalism that is spreading throughout the whole world.
Right.
Well, and something like that, just like a lot of other ways that people distribute cartoons on the internet, that police chief, the old way would have been for the police chief to call up the publisher and say, hey, call your dog off, you know, or something like that. But, you know, with everybody having the tools, it's a lot harder to do that, which can be great in a situation where Bro is dealing with, where you're, you know, trying to fight a dictator.
Yeah. We have situations of bloggers now that we are advocating for and protecting bloggers who are importing cartoons onto their blog sites. And the tyrants aren't going after the cartoonists, they're going after the bloggers.
Mm-hmm.
So bloggers are being arrested right and left all over the world, of course because of their own posts, but also because of the cartoons they bring into their blog sites and their websites to illustrate their points of view.
Well, that's interesting. I wanted to ask you guys, it seemed like there's somewhat of a sea change in the dynamics of editorial cartoons after the Danish newspaper published those 12 cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad in 2005. You know, there were massive violent protests that deterred media outlets from publishing cartoons degrading Islam. And the most prominent of those cartoonists was they tried to kill him. In retrospect, did that cause a lot of self-censorship? And is that impact still lingering?
Well, when I talked to Kurt Westergaard, I haven't spoken with him in about a year, but after this incident, I talked to him, and he said he and his wife are more committed than. And his whole family, he said, are more committed to free speech and telling the truth than they ever have been in their lives.
Right, and he was the cartoonist who depicted Muhammad with a bomb in his turban, right?
Yes, yeah. You know, it has woken up the whole journalism sector. I'll tell you, I've been doing this work for 20 years, and even the journalism support organizations that I work with and through sometimes have gone through a sea change in their view of the power of cartooning after the 12 Danish cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Practically all the major journalism support organizations like Reporters Sans Frontières, Human Rights Watch, Committee to Protect Journalists, are all paying close attention to the power of cartoons now and many of them have opened up cartoon sections on their websites.
Mm-hmm. Although I would say in the United States, it's been the opposite as far as self-censorship. I mean, the New York Times never actually ran those cartoons or showed their readers what was the issue that people were talking about. You know, cartoonists across the country haven't exactly been much quicker to draw Muhammad after that. And, you know, understandably, because of, you know, personal safety, and not to mention it's a lot harder to get something like that through a publisher. But I personally think that there are ways to do it, and, you know, and I've done it myself, but I think you have to do it with such care and mm-hmm. such caution that, you know, you need to show it in a respectful way. You need to show something that's forbidden like that in a respectful way and show why it's forbidden. You know, and I think overall, you know, in answer to the question, I think that it's increased self-censorship, at least around here. Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about how this banding together of cartoonists is helping both keep each other safe and also to spread each other's work. But before we continue our program, I want to remind everyone that you can listen anytime by downloading our podcasts from the website globaljournalist.org. Go to our website for a story on a former North Korean journalist. His cartoons provide an incredible insight into life in the Hermit Kingdom. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter @globaljorn. Now, bro, I saw when I was looking at Ferzat's cartoons, there was a video collection video interviews with the Arab cartoonists talking about how editorial cartoons played roles in the Arab Spring. Can you talk about the network of cartoonists and how that's changed?
Cartoonists, like any other political commentators or editorial writers, have a vastly wide base of political perspectives. You know, some are in favor of Mr. Mubarak and some are against Mr. Mubarak. What happened during the Arab Spring was that cartoonists of very, very different political backgrounds suddenly found themselves kind of all squished together, all pulling together and all identifying with each other, you know, with the common enemies that they were dealing with, instead of feeling loyalty to their own historical political perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, cartoonists came together in a very amazing way. I would like to refer people to something on our website at cartoonistwrites.org. That's cartoonist with an S, writes with an S, and one word, cartoonistwrites.org. Go to our front page and then go to our innovations drop-down. We have a wonderful story on the Arab Spring cartoonists mm-hmm. in Egypt and other places in the Arab world, with a bunch of links to YouTube videos and to other websites that are just amazing examples of the innovations and the creativity and the kind of, you know, on the barracks mentality that wall artists, graffiti artists, and cartoonists developed during the Arab Spring.
And Mark, can you talk about this and also where you see it going from here? I mean, it's hard to imagine where technology is going and how cartoonists can take advantage of it, but maybe your thoughts on some future trends.
On the technology side, I'm very hesitant to
yeah.
stick my neck out and make predictions, because honestly, in my career, I have largely just figured it out as I went along. I mean, you see some things coming down the pike, like when YouTube starts up or becomes popular, you know, you suddenly realize, wait, people are going to be able to put these on their blogs. People are going to be able to put videos all over the place. And it breaks down the walls a little bit. So I think things like that will continue, where you're going to, you know, combine technology like YouTube or something that allows cartoons or videos to get out there easier. You're going to combine that with social media even more, So it's going to be much more tie in with the people directly rather than having to go through an editor or a publisher.
Okay, bro, so, we have,
you know,
bro,
that's already the case, but it will continue too.
Okay, all right, thanks, Mark. Bro, well, we had just about 30 seconds. Your final word?
Editorial cartoons are, I consider them the bravest, most intelligent, most innovative journalists in the world. I'm, of course, biased. But the reason I do what I do is because I'm just in awe of what they can do, as you said earlier in the introduction to the program, with just a few strokes of a pen. You know, governments can be taken down.
Wow.
That doesn't happen very often. But as I once told an audience, where can you find people who have that much power and you pay so little?
Right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on the program and giving us this fascinating insight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Mikkel Christensen was our lead producer for this program. Stay with us for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a weekly segment on Global Journalist where we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Sasu Siegelbaum. Today's news comes from China, Argentina, and Kazakhstan. In accordance with International Press Freedom Day on May 3rd, Reporters Without Borders added Chinese President Xi Jinping to their list of predators of press freedom. The jihadist group Jabhat al-Nusra of Syria, members of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, Pakistan's Baloch armed groups, and Maldives' religious extremists were also added to the 39-member list. In a recent report from Freedom House, China ranked 179th out of 196 countries in press freedom. As of May 2013, Reporters Without Borders also cites 29 journalists and 68 netizens who have been imprisoned within the country. In Buenos Aires, at least 40 people were injured and 8 arrested, including a group of journalists, in a police raid of a demonstration by hospital workers. According to La Nación, hospital workers at the José T. Borda Hospital were impeding a government-sanctioned demolition of a workshop when police fired rubber bullets into the crowd and charged towards others. The injured journalists included newspaper photographers, television reporters, and camera operators. Reporters Without Borders condemned the use of excessive force by Buenos Aires Metropolitan Police and criticized city government for blaming journalists for their injuries. Hearings have begun in a case against 4 men charged with attacking a journalist in Kazakhstan. According to Radio Free Europe, preliminary hearings have taken place in the western Kazakh city of Oral. Lukhpan Akhmedyarov, a reporter at the independent newspaper Uralskaya Nedlia, was shot with an air pistol and stabbed on his way home from work in April 2012. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, he underwent surgery directly after the attack. After recovering, Akhmedyarov said that he thought the attack was a result of his journalistic work. His articles have often criticized Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev, and Akhmedyarov has had to pay several penalties for, quote, insulting local officials with his journalism. Though the 4 suspects have not been named, the judge set a trial date for May 14. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Sasu Siegelbaum.